listening to the Creative Pivot Podcast, and I am your host, Heather B. This podcast is all about women embracing their 40s, 50s, and beyond, and looking at what has stopped them in the past and stepping into the possibility of what this next chapter in their lives has in store. How do you move from pause to possibility? Well, I share stories of women that are doing just that, and I hope their stories inspire you as much as they have inspired me. Welcome to Season 2. This season will be releasing a new episode each Wednesday with a few bonus episodes sprinkled in. Those episodes might be interviewing someone who isn't over 40 or a woman, but has an inspiring story to share. Or it might be an episode where we discuss burnout, dreaming big, or my journey of creating my own business and how I can help you to take the leap. My guest for this episode is Stacy Cordova. For the past 25 years, Stacy has worked in education. She's worked as a teaching assistant, special education teacher, and an administrator. And after experiencing burnout, dealing with a traumatic family event, and seeing the pandemic wreak havoc on her family, friends, coworkers, and students' families, she started Self-Care Commune to help heal herself and help all of those around her to focus on adding more self-care to their daily lives. Her goal is to put more positivity out into the world. I hope you are inspired by Stacy's story, and I can't wait for you to hear more episodes from Season 2. Stacy, thank you for being on the podcast today. You are episode number one of Season 2. I'm so excited for this. And I think we have gotten to know each other a little bit better over the last few months. Although we were both a part of Made to Do This, I think it was through Still Made to Do This, which was one of our kind of just little alumni Facebook groups from Kathy Heller's program, that we really got to kind of know each other and start following each other, what we're doing. And you are the founder of Self-Care Commune. Why don't you introduce yourself to everybody?
Thank you. Thanks for having me on, Heather. It's been such a pleasure getting to know you. So I'm Stacy Cordova. I started a company called Self-Care Commune, and it's just a place that really helps with finding self-care in our daily lives and nurturing self-care. And just, it's not something that you just go get spas and massages for. It's something you do daily to help yourself. So that's been my mission. So it started in May, 2020.
It's been that kind of year.
It's been that kind of year. I feel like, yeah, we're 2020. But I just knew that I needed it. I knew that my daughter needed this. I knew that my sister and my friends and my coworkers. And I thought, if we need it, I know the world needs this. So that's my mission right now. The way that I did come to it is my trade is I'm a teacher. And I've been a teacher my entire adult life. And so I'm going on my, gosh, it's my 21st year of teaching. And I needed to really tap into feeding my soul. And that is how I've gotten to this place.
Yeah, because being a teacher, it is such a giver, you know, and it's a lot of compassion fatigue. And it's a lot to take care of, you know, these little souls that kind of you're trying to lead and help. And
so, yes. Yeah. And it's funny because it was probably about maybe my math here, but this was maybe about 7 years ago is when I started to really get the symptoms of burnout. And then later realizing that this is compassion fatigue. So just a little bit of background. I have been in special education my entire teaching career. I absolutely love special education. It is my mission. I know that I was meant here to do this. And I started out as an RSP teacher, working with kids with learning disabilities, working with kids with traumatic brain injury, autism. And back in the day, like autism was really rare. Um, or rarer. And, you know, working with just kids with that have learning issues. And so I did that for 7 years, loved it, but I started to want some change in my life. And so a position became open to teach kids who are blind and visually impaired. So I interviewed, I got the job, which meant that I had to go back to school and get the credentials. So I did. And I did that for about 7 years as well. And my district, knowing that when, you know, if they ask, I'll say yes to something, they asked me, hey, would you be willing to go back to school and
Just popping in here to let you know that we had a change in recording at this point in our interview. And so Stacey just called in instead of Zoom. And that is the only reason why there's just a little change in the quality of the call.
So I went back, got the credential, learned Braille, learned all the technology. And I loved that job. That's probably my most favorite of all my teaching positions. And I did that for about 7 years. And then my district, knowing that I was someone who always said yes, they asked, would you go back and work with go back to school so that you could work with students who are orthopedically impaired, medically fragile, or physically impaired? And I did it. And I did that for about another 7 years. So I seem to have like a 7-year itch. But during that time, I started to notice the signs of burnout. And for my case, it was definitely compassion fatigue, because during those years, you know, I had multiple students who passed away due to their conditions. I dealt with a lot of things with parents, because you're really dealing with parents grieving. They're grieving the loss of, they're grieving for their child. They're fearful for their child because they're afraid that their child, you know, what kind of quality of life are they going to have with the impairment that they have? And so you're dealing with a lot of like really hard issues. And then you're trying to teach the students. And so I started to notice the signs, and mine was manifesting in my hands. And I thought I had carpal tunnel, and then, you know, didn't have it. And so then I got this lucky opportunity where an old colleague called me and said, hey, would you be interested in applying for a position to be an administrator in this program? And so I jumped on it and I applied, and I ended up getting that job. And that is where it really exasperated. I did that for 3 years, and whoa, did it come on hard. I think towards the end, I definitely had some depression because it was, I just didn't want to do anything else. I had no energy for my family. I had no energy for anything else. All I could do was talk about work and deal with all of that. So I made the radical change to leave that and go back to the classroom and teach. So now I'm back to teaching the blind and the visually impaired, and I'm really loving it. But it was a long road to get there. A very long road.
Yeah, it's interesting that you and I both shared just in our chats that I also had that carpal tunnel manifestation, you know, where I went and, you know, went to my primary care and said, you know, I'm waking up in pain. My hands they're swollen. I had all the symptoms of being like on the computer and blah, 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 all, you know, all that kind of repetitive stress. But when I went in, they're like, no, everything's fine. You don't have it. I was like, really? I mean, I have to wear like braces to sleep and all this. And it's funny. You're the only one I've ever talked to. I would love to hear if there are more people out there who, you know, it just is how it manifested in you is one of the things you hear about, headaches and, you know, fatigue and all of that. But the carpal tunnel thing, I remember feeling almost embarrassed, like, well, that's weird. I must be making it up.
Yeah, exactly. And I kept going, like, I'm not making this up. Because there were a lot of people who were like, oh, you just want to go on workers' comp. And I'm like, no, I want to continue working. I don't want this problem, because it was so painful. Like, I'd not experienced pain like that, you know, in my hands. And exactly what you just said, I was not making this up. And it was so weird how your body manifests stress in such different ways. And I never heard of it in the hands either for anybody.
So yeah, well, I mean,
I'm glad I'm not alone.
Do you remember other times having kind of gone through stress in your career? Like you said, you've you know, you made some pivots, some changes along the way because of just things going on in your life where it was like, it's a good time to make this change. You know, it's good to make the change. But have you noticed just how you deal with stress and trauma changing as you've gotten older, like how you deal with it?
Oh, yes. So I'm pretty high energy, and I credit that to, I think I have an undiagnosed attention, you know, hyperactivity, which I think is a superpower now that I, you know, as I'm an adult, I have the energy to do things. But I used to bulldoze through things. Like growing up, my mom's mantra and you know, was just get over it. that was how what we were told as children, just get over it. Stop complaining, deal with it, move on. You know, so that was pretty much how I dealt with things. And so, yeah, my answer was just find a new path. And I'm grateful because I'm not scared of that, which I know that there's a lot of people who are scared of change. And that is one thing I'm not afraid of. I'm not afraid of change. Yeah, it's uncomfortable, but I know that the situation previously was uncomfortable. So I'd rather, for me, I'd rather try something new and explore. So yes, and now as an adult, I'm finding, and again, this goes along with my self-care, now I'm realizing that right now where I'm at in my life is the change I want is more calm, more peace. So everything I'm doing right now is, that is what I'm searching for, is things that bring more flow and ease into my life, as opposed to before, like bulldozing my way through it.
Well, I mean, I think that is definitely, bulldozing though is a coping mechanism. It's,
yes,
you know, instead of, you know, flight, fight, or freeze, I see bulldozing as that fighting. You're like, I am getting through this, because some things you go through in life, that's just how you're going to survive. The fighting is how you survive. It does not mean you're thriving. The thriving comes with learning how to deal with things as they come up, you know, but when you're younger, that's not always something that you have those skill set for. I think you have gone through so many just different things in your life. And just as you get older, you learn those lessons. But as you get older, you're really tired of putting up with stuff too. So I think your body, it manifests in your body before your head, before you realize what's happening.
You are so right. And it's funny that you bring that up, because I, you know, it is embarrassing. I don't want to be considered someone who's a fighter, but I totally am. And I have been this way since I was a kid. I've always been extremely feisty. I was always short. So everyone would be like, oh, she's so tiny, and always lifting me up. And it would always annoy me, and I'd get really upset, because I'd be like, leave me alone. And so, yeah, I've always been feisty, always been a fighter. And now I'm feeling it. Like, I literally wake up now and I feel like I've been in a boxing match, and I'm like, what's wrong with me? My back hurts. You know, so everything I'm about now is releasing that need to fight all the time. It's just, I can just be in flow. I want to create a new one. It's fight, flight, freeze. And then I want to create flow. And that is my destination right now.
Yeah. That is perfect. That's what we need to do so much more of, especially when you're dealing with burnout. And when, I mean, I think so many catalysts for pivot, especially women, and I would say women over 40, 40s and 50s, they hit a wall. And I think it is burnout, whether they realize that's what it is or not, but they hit a wall of saying, I'm not going to take crap anymore. And
I agree.
Like, you just are like, I need to put myself first, or I'm going to fall apart. And your body just starts manifesting all these different things to say, you have put everybody ahead of you for a very long time. If you don't stop it, I'm just going to stop working until you can figure out, you know, what you need to thrive. Why don't you talk a little bit about the 30-day self-care challenge that you just completed in September, and kind of maybe not just the change you saw with people that were a part of it, and I was a part of it, but the change in yourself from kind of day one to day 30.
Thank you. And, you know, I actually have to give you a lot of credit for this, because when I was listening to you talk about burnout, you talked about that if you don't heal yourself,
of those types of wounds, you're going to continue the burnout if you change jobs. And so I left my administrative position in July and I started my new teaching job in August. And in hearing you say that, I just was like, it just really rang in my head. And I'm like, I don't want to recreate the same patterns that I was having before. So what could I do to set me off in this new job in a positive way? And also help others, because that's always been my mission, is how can I help others, whether that's teaching or whether that's now this self-care commune. So I, you know, September's coming. I love an alliteration. So self-care September just kind of kept screaming at me. So I started to plan it and I just wanted to create 30 days of self-care strategies that could just help anyone. And that really actually helped me. And they're all things that I had done over the last, you know, couple months in giving myself that much needed self-care. And so I created these little daily tasks. I mean, they were, and I call them my radical acts of self-care, but they're also random acts of self-care. Because, and I said this quite often, but we give other people random acts of kindness all the time. I know that I try to in my life, but how often do we give ourselves those random acts of self-care? You know, those random little things like just looking at ourselves in the mirror and saying, I love you. I love who you are. You know, buying yourself flowers at the grocery store for $3.99, those little types of things. And so the whole challenge was based on those. So, you know, right now we're in quarantine, so it's not like we can actively go out and get massages or go have a spa day at, you know, a great spa. But we can do those little things at home, you know, which is go buy a mask and do it at home. And so I had so much fun with it. And the crazy part is that I feel like I had a lot of great feedback from people saying, thank you for this. Thank you for giving me permission to do this. I've thought of self-care as so selfish before, and now it's, I don't think of it as that. But I feel like I got so much more out of it because people were just so kind in their, in being thankful for this. And I didn't realize that people needed permission to do this. And it's so weird because I guess really it felt like they finally got permission to do this for themselves. So I think that's been the biggest takeaway from this is we all have that permission to take this time. We don't have to keep giving until we're depleted. You can take your time and, you know, give yourself 10 minutes in the morning to write in your journal. Because that 10 minutes adds up to bringing such, I think, happiness and calm. And that's what I've been doing over these last couple of months. And actually, for the past 2 years, I've really been working on.
I have talked to a number of women and some of the clients that I've worked with about self-care. And I think you and I are in the same path. Like having a bubble bath is great, but that cannot be the only thing that you think of in self-care, which is why I think that some people do think that they have to get permission. It's not going and getting a manicure. That's great. But it can just be as simple as going in a room, closing the door, taking a really good book, and just reading, even for 15 minutes, like just those little moments. It doesn't have to be spending, you know, money or pampering yourself. It can just be that the care that you would never think to get permission from to give to someone else. We somehow think we need permission to give to ourselves. And yeah, that's such a strange kind of maybe paradigm. And I think a lot of, especially women, but people that are in those giving roles, and they talk about that they go into, like you said, you thought maybe I want to be a nurse and go into teaching and any kind of like service role, especially, or mm-hmm. anyone that goes into a job where no matter what it is, they want to be of service. How can they help others? Just that mentality. Sometimes it's because they're so uncomfortable taking care of themselves, but they need to fill that cup in some way of taking care, you know, of giving care to others, but they're the worst at taking care of themselves. And that is definitely something practicing and doing it on a regular basis is so important, especially with burnout. I know I was not doing it at all when I was going through burnout. And I think a lot of women are not doing that. So what is next for self-care commune or for Stacy?
You know, I have a lot of projects in the books right now. And again, the self-care commune actually too came out of my need just to re-energize myself, recharge my batteries, because I'm actually working on a book that details my family's history with eugenics, which I know is so incredibly, incredibly random. But with everything with that happened this summer with George Floyd and just all the racial injustice, I felt it was really important to share my family's story. I'm Mexican American. I've been born and raised in California, and my family, I'm about third generation. My grandparents came from, my great grandparents came from Mexico, and they settled in Arcadia, California, and near Pasadena. And my aunt shared a story with me a long time ago. I was at Loyola Marymount, that's where I went to college, and I took a Chicano studies class. The assignment was to interview someone, you know, that was Mexican American, and just kind of to ask them some questions about their lives and growing up. And so I interviewed my aunt, who, my Aunt Mary, and I had no clue I was going to get the story that I got. She shared with me, it's not funny at all, but it just is so weird that she shared this with me, but she shared that when she was 13, that her parents and my grandfather, which was her brother, put her into an asylum because she was, and I'm using air quotes, a wild young girl. The sad part was is that she was actually being molested by a neighbor, but the family was so terrified that she was going to get pregnant that they put her into this asylum. And she was forcibly sterilized at 13 years old. So I immediately went to my mom and was like, what is this? What happened? And she's like, this is true. This happened. It was such a shameful family secret. No one ever wanted to talk about it. But the fact that she was around 77 when she shared this with me, and she actually died shortly after our interview. And so I'm like, just so incredibly grateful to her for sharing this family story with me and sharing her painful story with me, because I feel like it's my mission to tell her story. So how does this relate to George Floyd? How does this relate to all of this? Well, you know, this eugenics was happening to people who were deemed unfit, who were deemed unworthy. And my aunt was deemed that. My aunt was labeled feeble-minded due to social deviance. Mm-hmm. And at that time, they were labeling people different things, but it was primarily happening to people with disabilities, but also mostly it was to African-American, Mexican-Americans, Native American Indians, anyone deemed unfit during 1934 and on. So these laws were in the books from like 1906 to in California as late as 1971. But a sad fact is it was actually happening in the jail system up until 2011. Wow. So this whole progressive movement that was happening in the early 1900s just is systemic racism. And I feel like I need to share the story, because if I was born in 1934, this would have happened to me too, because I was a teen mom. I had a baby at 15. It was 1992. I had my daughter. She's now 28. And I think if I had been born when she was born, I would have had the same procedure done to me. Mm-hmm. I would have been labeled socially deviant, feeble-minded due to social deviance. And I just feel like I have to share her story. I have to share her story. And I am going to intertwine my story, because I think that I just want to show the relationship. But, and I also want to share about eugenics, because so many people don't know about it. So although this is extremely random and off, you know, like how do we go from self-care to eugenics? I started this self-care also because I needed to pump me up, because it was really depressing research. And it was really hard to tackle. And I felt like I was going from one frying pan to another in dealing with depressing topics. So that's where I'm at. That's what I'm doing right now and working.
But you know, it's one of those things of maybe coming to realize the importance of taking care of yourself, because the service that you're doing, and whether it's you teaching or just the service of helping to tell your aunt's story, to tell your own story, you know, you have to keep your cup full in order to be balanced, you know, instead, in order to tell the story from a place that is not full of despair and fatigue, because you're not taking care of yourself.
You're so right on. I love that you said that, because it's yes, I want this to come from a place of love, This is coming from a place of, I want to share this so others know, because I think knowledge is, we need to know this history. I keep using the quote from Mark Twain, which, you know, history may not repeat itself, but it certainly does rhyme. And I just think, my gosh, when everything came out about the ICE facilities, I just was like, you know, people were, you know, people who knew I was on this journey were sending me messages. They're like, can you believe this? Can you believe what's happening? And I'm like, no, I can't believe it. And people don't know the history and they need to know, or else we will be doomed to go back to that. And I don't want to see that happening again. So yeah, you're so right.
You know, it is one of those things that I think when I found, when you were talking about it, telling your story, telling your aunt's story and about writing this book. And I think it was during the self-care challenge because of the news that was coming out of the ICE facilities with the forced hysterectomies. And it was something that I think, because I can be comfortable enough in my privilege of being born at a time where it's not going to happen to me, or being, you know, a white, you know, able cisgender, you know, person, that you think it's happened in the past, but it's not happening now. You know, and because there's always a way to give an excuse for bad behavior. And I think that that is, with everything that's going on right now, is something that when you really look at the fight, you know, the fight for equality, because it did not end at any certain point, it is still going. And every time we see a article or a video or a protest, you have to really understand that it's because this is our story as a country, and you need to have your eyes wide open and realize what is happening and stand up when you see injustice and stand up and say, yes, I want to share stories. I want to do this. I want people to know what has happened to them. Because it's one thing for you to say, well, 1934, you know, that's not, but no, it is still happening. And like you said, you know, in the prison system too, I think there is a lot of things that has allowed to happen in the prison system. And in California, a lot of things in the prison system that have occurred where it's, well, they're in prison. So, you know, it's that excuse every time, but we're all human beings and we all need to take care of one another and make sure that these things are not happening, because it's like that, that poem that was, you know, the one that's all about, you know, they came for the Jews, but I'm not Jews. So I, you know, it's always like at some point you're alone, and then who is going to have your back if you haven't had anyone else's? So
it's,
I love
so true
that you're working on this and that you're doing that.
Thank you. I do have to share this one thing, because it goes along with what you're saying right now, is it is still a law in the U.S. Supreme Court. It's still considered constitutional to forcibly sterilize somebody.
That's crazy.
It's Buck versus Bell. It's fascinating. And a part of writing this book is this needs to be reversed. This law needs to be taken out of that. It's fascinating if you go and read it.
You know, sometimes you think that, you know, you have a seed that's kind of planted in you. So like you said, you found out about this when you were in college, you know, with the story about your aunt. And that seed is kind of like, when she told you, did you think, I'm going to write a book about this one day? Or did it sit with you for a while because it needed your own life experience, your own story to really kind of fertilize, let it grow, you know, those roots kind of spread out in you of really understanding what that story was going to look like, you know, as you got older. And now you're at the place to tell it. But at a place when you were in college thinking, I'm going to write a book would have been so different from what it will look like now.
Oh, I never even thought I was going to write a book about this. In fact, I had no clue that this happened and that this was something that was happening in history. I thought that this was a shameful family secret, and that shame on my family for doing this to this poor young girl. It was not, this is how it start. This is where the seed started to get planted, was in 2016 or 2017, I was listening to NPR. I want to say it was 2016. And I was driving in the car and I'm listening to this Professor Dr. Stern from University of Michigan sharing about the eugenics movement, and that in the state of California, it was predominantly happening to Mexican Americans, and that they had proof of this, and that her researchers had been doing work at the archives and found that the majority of the 20,000 people that were sterilized in California, and by the way, California was the number one sterilizer of the country, it was primarily to Mexican Americans and Mexican American women. And so she's talking, she's sharing the story. And like, I have to tell you, I actually forgot about what my aunt had told me. And then, I mean, you don't forget it, but you just, you know, it kind of got, was like shoved into the recesses of my mind. And so I'm listening to her speak, I'm hearing this, and I had to pull over because I just had to keep writing what she was saying. I found her information and I emailed her. And I said, Dr. Stern, this happened to my aunt. She immediately got back to me, put me in contact with her researchers, and they found all of my aunt's documents. They found where she was located. They found the letters from the judges saying it, what they labeled her as. They found the signatures from my family. They found everything. And it just, that is when I knew, like, I kind of thought, I think I have to tell my aunt's story. But, you know, again, I'm working, I'm dealing with a stressful job. I'm like, I don't have time for this. And then it was George Floyd's murder. Mm-hmm. And I'm normally a very quiet person. I'm not one who like posts a lot on Facebook. I do now, but I'm not one to do a lot of activism. I don't even usually put signs out in front of my house because I'm just quiet about my politics or quiet. And I thought, screw this. I've got to shout from the rooftops what's happening. I need to share this story. This needs to happen. And so that happened, and now I've been working on it ever since.
Yeah, I think that's amazing work. And I'm glad that you're putting it out there, because I know, like, for a while you did kind of keep it under wraps a little bit, right? Like, you shared mm-hmm. with some, but not everybody knew. But you wanted to give power, almost to empower the story, because once you told everyone about it, like announced, I'm doing this, that gives it its own life. Like, you're birthing it, basically. Like, it's now on a path and you're coming along with it, but it's gonna, you know, it's out there.
Yeah, it is. And I'm really excited for it. I'm just so grateful to have so many amazing researchers who've helped me through the process and shared their, you know, research and information with me. And it's like, we have this really interesting little cohort of people all into eugenics, and it's so strange, you know, but we're on the other side of eugenics. You know, we're like, mm-hmm. you know, I don't recommend anybody hashtag eugenics, because you're going to come across a lot of racist propaganda. But especially on Instagram. But the history of this is so fascinating, and it's just so sad. So it needs to be told so that the young people know what's going on. And I can't believe I just said young people. I'm not that old, by the way.
Kids these days need to know. Yeah.
I know.
No, I think, you know, sometimes telling your story and telling other stories, because although your aunt told you, you know, when you approached your mom with it and she let you know, well, yes, that's true. And the shame, we're shamed into not telling our stories. And so when we tell mm-hmm. them, it feels kind of wrong. It feels like that same thing about self-care, that we need permission to tell our stories. And as I, you know, kind of shared of just telling a bit of my story on the last episode, it didn't feel right, but yet that's the whole purpose of this podcast, is to share stories and to give the space and the room for feeling safe in telling those stories. So yeah, we all have to be reminded of that. It's easier for us to give than to receive. So that's an important, I think, a lesson for us all.
So right. Thank you for creating this space too. It's just been so great to hear everyone's stories and hear your story. And thank you for letting me share mine.
Well, I am so glad that you were able to be a part of this and be episode one of season two. So the definition of eugenics, for those of you that might not be familiar with the term, this comes from Oxford Languages definition. It's the study of how arranging reproduction within a human population to increase the occurrence of heritable characteristics regarded as desirable. This process was discredited as unscientific and racially biased during the 20th century, especially after the adoption of its doctrines by the Nazis in order to justify their treatment of Jews, disabled people, and other minority groups. So now you know a little bit more about the subject matter, but why it's so important to educate people on the subject, how it happened here in the U.S., how it continues to happen in different ways with the control of our reproduction. And I just can't wait to read this book from Stacy, because I know it's going to be just fascinating and beautiful, as I think everything she puts out there is. I hope you join Self Care Commune. I want you to know that you do not need any permission to take a few minutes out of each day and take care of yourself, whether it's reading a book, whether it's sitting in the car a couple extra minutes with no one bothering you, whether it is knowing that maybe you need someone to talk to and reaching out and finding that person. As much as we are separated right now, there are ways for us to come together. And I hope that you seek out those sources and know that in order to take care of one another, we need to take care of each other first. Thank you for listening to The Creative Pivot, and maybe it's time for you to make a creative pivot of your own.